And now to the longevity of one of the oldest dynasties in the Middle East, the Assad dynasty of Syria. Ever since Hafez al-Assad came to power in a bloodless coup in 1970, he managed to exasperate 9 American presidents, count them, of both Democratic and Republican persuasion. Time-consuming, nerve-wracking, and bizarre. Thus Henry Kissinger described his sessions with this dynastic founder. And while his son Bashar al-Assad was initially regarded by some in the US administration as a reformer, he has now proven that he's anything but. And in the words of our next guest, nor does he possess his father's shrewd instincts or even much common political sense. Robin Wright had written an account of America's relationship with the al-Assad dynasty in a recent New Yorker. Robin is contributing writer for the New Yorker, a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's the author of many books, and most recently editor of The Islamists Are Coming, Who They Really Are. I made the obvious point that sometimes tyrannies just evaporate. They disappear in a puff of smoke or a well-aimed bullet like Ceausescu, while others like Mugabe just survive against all the odds. And I asked her whether she was surprised that the Assad regime is still around.
Well, it is the most enduring dynasty in the Middle East today, and it has defied now 9 American presidents over almost half a century. Time and again, the Americans have reached out to him because Syria is the strategic center of the Middle East, and the Assad dynasty has control over so much of what happens, whether it's conflict or whether it's diplomacy. And so any effort to establish a broader peace, whether it's Arab-Israeli or in dealing with ISIS, all the problems of the Middle East need Syrian cooperation. And when the Assad dynasty has chosen to defy the outside world, particularly the West, it has proven deadly for many Western governments.
Robin, let us remind ourselves how the dynasty began. Where did Dad come from?
Well, Hafez al-Assad was the 9th of 11 children, grew up in a really rough mountain area with a kind of defiant minority tribe, the Alawites. And he was the first in his family to go to high school. He took advantage of the Ba'ath Socialist Party opening up the system to gain an education and a position within the Syrian Air Force. But Syria was very unstable during its first 20 years after independence from France. And there were 20 coups in 21 years, some successful, some not. And at the age of 35, Assad became the defense minister. And by the age of 40, he became president by launching the last of those 20 coups and bringing a certain degree of stability through his ruthlessness and brutality.
I've already quoted you on the contrast between father and son, and you say of Dad, shrewd instincts and even much common political sense. So he must have been in many ways an impressive figure.
Well, this is according to many of the interlocutors from Washington. Henry Kissinger called him one of the shrewdest politicians he had ever met. I think it was Bill Clinton who said he was a brilliant man, ruthless, but a brilliant man who'd once wiped out a village as a lesson to his opponents. So all of them, I think, respected his shrewdness, his ability to look after the interests not just of Syria, but the entire Arab world. His position about peace with Israel was always that he wanted strategic parity. That was the term he used time and again. And he didn't want the Arabs to feel that they were so marginalized, that they had no power in defending themselves and looking after broader Arab interests. And that's why he was such a tough interlocutor.
I have to tell the listener your story about Kissinger, that when he first met Hafez al-Assad, the meeting went on so long, over 6 hours that everyone thought that Henry had been kidnapped.
Yes, it was almost 11 o'clock at night, and the traveling press with him thought that he might not be coming back at all. And these marathon sessions were notorious. There was another one with James Baker, who was the Secretary of State under the first President Bush. And the session went on 9 hours and 45 minutes, to the point that Baker once had to wave a white handkerchief in submission so he could get a bathroom break. No one could understand how this man could talk on for so long, drinking tea and coffee and water during the process, and not have to take a break.
It's a touch of Castro about him.
Yes, absolutely. And as you pointed out, Robert Mugabe, I actually interviewed Mugabe the day after he was elected. And I have to say, he has defied both the actuarial tables as well as, you know, the life of most political life of most leaders anywhere in the world.
Perhaps the three of them have in common, they can turn on the charm. Everyone I've spoken to who's dealt with Mugabe in the way that you did talked about his almost seductive charm. And also, I think the three of them also wielded a sense of humor.
Yes, a wry sense of humor. And it was often the kind of barbs against either opponents or even the countries of the interlocutors. He did have a wry sense of, Assad had a wry sense of humor. I think these men all have something in common. They have a vision. They have an ideology. They have the tools in the security forces they control. They have enough support. The rule of thumb is that a dictator needs 30% of support at home to survive, because he can get over the hump of support by the majority by using security tools to crack down on any opponents, whether it's locking them up, beating them up, or killing them. And I think this is a common denominator among all three of those leaders.
I would have thought there's perhaps a fourth character that lines up with at least some of those criteria, but we won't mention Donald Trump. I am talking to Robin Wright about the Assad dynasty. Now, Robin, I don't wish to be tedious, but are you absolutely 100% convinced that it was the Assad regime that was responsible for the recent chemical weapons attack, and that it wasn't a false flag operation?
You know, this is not my intelligence. I'm going by what the United States says, and the United States has been deeply flawed in the past, notably in Iraq, in asserting that there were Saddam Hussein still had chemical weapons. So, you know, one is never sure, but I will say the intelligence seems to be certainly, you know, convincing at this stage, since they have the planes, they have the satellite imagery of those planes flying over the area and dropping these bombs. So, you know, that's all I can tell you. The Assad dynasty has in the past used chemical weapons. And one of the stories I broke in 2007 was that it was also working on a secret nuclear program that nobody had known about, with the help of the North Koreans, and the Israelis eventually bombed it. The U.S. got very good intelligence through samples on the ground and other inside intelligence. And because at first the Bush administration, second Bush administration, was not fully convinced that this, you know, that Syria out of the blue had built a nuclear program. So this is a regime that has intentions of using chemical weapons. We know that the Nobel-winning group that specializes, the OPCW, has went in and confirmed the use of chemical weapons in the past. Assad is, you know, first of all, you have to look at why he might have used chemical weapons. And there are a number of reasons. One is that he's got a manpower problem. And second, Idlib, the province where he bombed, is now the stronghold of various rebel groups, from Al-Qaeda to the U.S.-backed rebels. It is the province that has been most defiant. And when you have a manpower problem and you're trying to terrify the locals, chemical weapons is arguably the most effective weapon.
And yet, if that's the case, if he is absolutely 100% guilty, what a silly thing to do, because it's brought the wrath of the gods down, and even more importantly, the wrath of Donald Trump.
Well, I don't know about Donald Trump, but I'm not sure. I kind of think that Obama would have done this too if he'd used chemical weapons. And in some ways, this may have been a test of how far Trump was prepared to go. So,
but Trump, of course, said in the past that Obama didn't respond when he should have anyway. Do you see these American strikes as now a part of a strategy to actually end the dynasty?
No, I don't. And I think this was reactive to chemical weapons, and I don't think that President Trump will do anything more in the end in when it comes to dealing with the barrel bombs that have been so deadly. I've seen many victims of these barrel bombs. I've been covering ISIS and the Syrian regime now for the past, well, the Assad dynasty since 1980, but the ISIS phenomenon and the civil war for 6 years now. On the ground, and you know, what he has done is just reprehensible. It's shocking. You know, 500,000 people dead, 2/3 of his population depended on international aid just for daily bread. The displacement of 5 million people, forcing them, you know, to flee the country, and another 11 million who are displaced from their homes inside Syria. The greatest humanitarian crisis. I don't think that his father would have done this. I think Bashar Assad is far more insecure and, as a result, far more militant. In some ways, like the current North Korean leader, the next generations of the original founder of a dynasty tends to be inherit a legacy they feel they have to defend, and they will go further than often the founders in defending it. Go ahead.
No, well, Robin, not so long ago, as we were saying earlier, the Americans were describing Assad as a reformer. Did they believe that, or did they want it, or was it a sort of a wish fulfillment fantasy?
It was an illusion. This was a man who was younger. He was interested in the internet and 21st century technology. He married a wife who'd been educated in the West, born in Britain, who had been an investment banker at J.P. Morgan. There was a sense that he was going to open up Syria, that there were reforms ahead, but it was always an illusion. And yes, the United States got duped, as did many others in the West, thinking that this was going to be something different, perhaps more flexible in dealing with regional challenges. And of course, he wasn't. He never had, as you pointed out, the sense of the political common sense in dealing with the outside world. And, you know, the Syrian tragedy will be one that haunts us for a long time to come, because it's not clear that Syria itself will ever be, whether it's one centralized country again, one state, whether, you know, it will be, the devastation just physically will be a gargantuan task in terms of reconstruction. But the question is also about political reconstruction. Is this country now so fractured? Has there been so much ethnic cleansing that the melting pot that was Syria is no more? Again, and whether it reverts the kind of instability and that we saw in its first 20 years. And so there are a lot of big questions that lie ahead about this country, even after the Assad dynasty.
You're listening to Middle Eastern expert Robin Wright on LNL on RN Summer. Robin is author and distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Let's go back to Kissinger. He did squeeze some concessions out of Dad, didn't he, following the 1973 Arab-Israeli war. But of course, it took him 28 trips.
Yes, and 14 of those trips were in a single month. But
I'm sorry. Really?
Yes. And this was shuttle diplomacy. It was the first time Kissinger's trips actually gave us the term shuttle diplomacy. And he, in dealing with the aftermath of the 1973 war, he did finally come up with a disengagement plan for Syrian and Israeli troops on the Golan Heights. And that agreement has stuck to this day. It is the one of the most important, it was a means of devolving tensions. And Kissinger hoped
it led, as I recall, to Nixon actually visiting Damascus.
Yes, he was the first American president in 1974. And can you imagine? He drove in an open car down the main boulevard of Damascus with American flags flapping along the boulevard and signs that declared, "Welcome Richard Nixon to revolutionary Damascus." He got a 21-gun salute. There was a state dinner in which the two leaders toasted each other. It's just unimaginable today. But it was the first effort shortly after Assad purged his way to power to deal with Syria. And Nixon said at the time, as several American presidents have since said, that Syria was important in solving the region's problems. And of course, the Nixon administration and the Ford administration that followed had hoped that they could convert Kissinger's disengagement agreement into a broader regional peace. And of course, every president after that tried the same thing.
Well, let me throw another presidential name into the discussion, and that's Carter. Al-Assad was the most uncompromising Arab leader in his opposition to Israel, in particular to the seizure and occupation of the Golan Heights. And Carter found him completely immovable on this issue, didn't he, in 1977?
Yes, and Carter met with him. But this is, again, where the idea of strategic parity came up. Carter had hoped that he could, with the Soviet Union, organize a broader regional peace conference. And he found Assad unyielding on principle and willing to face both political and military confrontations in order to protect the idea or force the outside world to deal with the concept of strategic parity between the Arabs and Israel. And when that failed, Carter went on and brokered peace between Israel and Egypt, at which point Assad, in revenge, turned to the Soviet Union and deepened ties between Damascus and Moscow.
You introduced the term shuttle diplomacy before in relationship to Kissinger. 14 trips in 1 month, that's a trip every 2 days, but you were present on most of the 30 trips of the Secretary of State Warren Christopher to Damascus.
Indeed I was, and he thought he could negotiate a deal between Syria and Israel. And he kept, every trip, he kept coming back on the plane and saying, "We're close, we're very close." They really thought they could get some kind of deal that would basically involve the Golan Heights. And President Clinton met with Assad as well. He was the second American president to go to Damascus, and he met him in Geneva as well. And again, they couldn't come up with a deal that satisfied Assad, and it fell apart.
I think you're giving vivid evidence, or we better understand the dynasty's intractability. And of course, I'm wondering whether the U.S. strike, the Trump strike, has made the Russians more determined to support Assad.
Well, it's a good question, and I think in some ways we need to understand that Syria is to the Russians what Israel is to the United States, that this is a country for the Russians that it's only real ally in the Middle East. It is a long-standing strategic relationship that gives the Russians an in to not just Syria, but then as a result, all the conflicts in the region. It also just physically gives the Russians access to a Mediterranean port, a very important air base that's under Assad's control.
Robin, so, we've got to wrap it, but thank you for another marvelous contribution to our little program. Robin Wright, contributing writer for The New Yorker and a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and I'm sure that we'll be talking again.